Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Audience. Pope Benedict looks at the figure of Simeon, the 10th century Eastern monk, during his Wednesday general audience. Pope and Observatory. Later on Wednesday, Pope Benedict was scheduled to visit and inaugurate the new headquarters of the Vatican Observatory in the gardens of the papal residence in Castel Gandolfo. And we speak to the director of the observatory about this move. Thérèse's Little Way. As the first ever tour in Britain of the relics of St. Thérèse of Lisieux gets underway, we find out more about the hopes and expectations surrounding this visit and examine the special appeal of this 19th century saint who's been dubbed a Catholic global superstar. And cooped up in camps. With international concern growing over the plight of nearly 300,000 detained Tamil civilians being held in grossly overcrowded government-run camps in Sri Lanka, we find out more about conditions inside from a British bishop who's just returned from a tour of the camps. Pope Benedict looked at the figure of Simeon, the 10th century Eastern monk and scholar, at his Wednesday general audience. Lydia Kane tells us more.
The love of God grows in us if we remain united to him in prayer and listen to his word. Those were Pope Benedict's words at his general audience on Wednesday, as thousands gathered to hear his latest instalment on the early fathers of the Church, this week focusing on St. Simeon, known as the new theologian.
He was born in the year 949 in Asia Minor. As a young man, he moved to Constantinople to embark on a career in the civil service. But during his studies, he was shown a work called The Spiritual Law by Mark the Monk, which completely changed his life. It contains a phrase, "If you seek spiritual healing, be aware of your conscience. Do everything it tells you, and you will find what is useful to you."
The Holy Father continued on this theme of conscience, saying that St. Simeon made it his way of life always to listen to his conscience, and added that this saint's example shows us that by giving attention to the spiritual life, the Holy Spirit becomes really present in us.
True knowledge of God comes not from books, but from an interior purification through conversion of the heart. For Simeon, union with Christ is not something extraordinary, but the fruit of the baptism common to all Christians.
Finally, looking out at the sea of people gathered in the Paul VI hall, the Pope prayed that the life of this saint would inspire greater attention to our spiritual life, seeking the guidance we need to grow in the love of God. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
Following the audience, Pope Benedict was scheduled to visit and officially inaugurate the new headquarters of the Vatican Observatory in Castel Gandolfo. The observatory had been housed inside the Papal Palace in Castel Gandolfo for more than half a century, but recently moved to a nearby completely renovated convent located in the Papal Gardens, where they have bigger and more modern facilities. Father Jose Funes is the present director of the Vatican Observatory. And he spoke to my colleague Emma McCarthy about their new headquarters.
Yes, we are in the new headquarters of the Vatican Observatory since maybe something like about 8 weeks, 10 weeks. And now we are ready to start this new phase in the history of the Vatican Observatory. About 3 years ago, we started with the project of moving the Vatican Observatory from the Pontifical Palace in Castel Gandolfo to these new facilities. The reason for that is, on one side, the activity, of course, that the Holy Father has during the summertime in the Pontifical Palace, and on the other side, the growing activities of the Vatican Observatory, especially during the summer. We have summer schools for young astronomers from almost all over the world. We have meetings, workshops. So in order to help the activity of the Vatican Observatory, we were given these new facilities, that is an old monastery that has been remodeled for us. And now we have here the library, our offices, and the house for the Jesuit community. We also have here the collection of meteorites, which is very precious. We have a moon rock. We also have old books. So this is an important part of our research too, because there is a brother Guy Consolmagno who does his research with the meteorites, and there is an important field of our research, which is the history of astronomy. The Vatican Observatory is a very old institution, so there are many important things, events that in the past happened, are part of our history. And so these are more or less the reasons for which we are here now.
Now you have moved, but you haven't moved that far. You're still within the boundaries of the Vatican summer residence. You're more or less guests in the Pope's garden, if I'm not mistaken.
You're right. We are inside the Vatican gardens in Castel Gandolfo, but closer to Albano.
That was Father Jose Funes, director of the Vatican Observatory, speaking to Emma McCarthy. For the first time ever, the relics of Saint Thérèse of Lisieux, one of the world's best-loved saints, are in the UK and will be travelling across England and Wales over the next 4 weeks. Born in 1873, Thérèse spent all her adulthood in a Carmelite convent in northern France and died at the age of 24. But despite her short and uneventful life, Thérèse's fame soon spread around the globe, following the publication of her autobiography, The Story of a Soul, shortly after her death. As a measure of its appeal, the autobiography has been translated into some 50 languages, millions of copies have been sold, and it's never been out of print. Shortly after the centenary of her death in 1997, St. Thérèse's relics began touring the world and have visited over 40 countries to date. In Britain, the historic tour of her relics officially got underway on Wednesday in the southwestern city of Portsmouth, and organisers are expecting large crowds to turn out at many of the 22 different venues the relics will visit, that include many Catholic cathedrals and parishes, a prison, a hospice, and an Anglican cathedral. The national organiser of the tour of Thérèse's relics in England and Wales is Monsignor Keith Baltrop, director of the Catholic Agency to Support Evangelisation, and he spoke to me about his hopes and expectations just ahead of the visit.
I think the main significance is that it gives people a very concrete opportunity to focus on the communion of saints, and in particular this remarkable saint who was not only so much blessed by God, but has clearly been given a mission to the church. I mean, we've been speaking a lot about evangelization in the last few years in the church, and St. Thérèse, of course, is patron of the mission. I think her visit will act as a stimulus to people to engage in a deeper in mission at a deeper level.
How and why did the request for this visit of her relics come about?
St. Thérèse's, I would say, always been much loved in England and Wales. I mean, some of the great writers on St. Thérèse have been English. One thinks of people like Monsignor Vernon Johnson. There are thousands, possibly millions of people in England who love St. Thérèse. And hearing about the way her relics have travelled around many other countries of the world, I think it was natural that people began to wonder, well, why hasn't she been here?
In fact, you mentioned how they've travelled around the world. In fact, I gather they've already been to 40 other countries. Why does this 19th century nun, who lived almost all of her life in a small remote town in northern France, have this huge global appeal?
It is extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, there is, if you read her writing somewhere, she does have this remarkable statement that I want to be a missionary till the end of time. I want to be a missionary on all five continents. I mean, it sounds, I suppose, like the typical sort of youthful daydreaming or idealism, but the extraordinary thing is, through her visit of her relics, she has, in a way, had her dream come true. It's an extraordinary story, I suppose, of the power of God, of how God works through people who are very little and humble. Yeah, I suppose precisely at a time in the 20th century, you know, when the two great power blocks of communism and Nazism were seen to be battling it out for the soul of the world, it's as if God was saying, well, you know, I work in a different way. I work through small people, humble people, and yet very, very powerfully, much more powerfully and much more long-lasting.
And it was her autobiography, The Story of a Soul, that was published almost by accident, I gather, after her death, that made her famous. Why does this book have such an impact? I gather it's been translated into 50 languages and millions of copies have been sold, and it's never been out of print. I mean, these are fairly amazing statistics, aren't they?
Yes, I mean, like many saints, or great mystics for that matter, St. Therese was reluctant naturally to speak about herself. She would never have publicized herself. It was only at the command of her superiors, one of whom, of course, was her natural sister, who had some inkling of what was going on in her life, that she wrote her autobiography. Still, even when she died, most of the sisters in the convent, thought that she was fairly unremarkable. It's hard to say. I mean, one has to admit that, you have to get past a little bit of the sugary language, a bit like the image that sort of touched up image of her that was purveyed by some of the nuns after her death. But once you get beyond that, you see someone, it's something about the extreme simplicity and the obvious sincerity and authenticity of what she experienced and the sheer depth of it. Like so many of the saints, like the Curia of Ars, who we're thinking about in this year of the priesthood, it seems very simple and almost obvious on the surface. I was going to use the word banal, but that might be the wrong word to use. But if you allow yourself to be touched by it, you see there's extraordinary depths in it, that something of the simplicity of her message, the little way of spiritual childhood, speaks to people in a very complicated age. It's not superficial. It's something of the way that God really touches you if you allow yourself to be empty and humble and not self-sufficient, but open to his grace.
Now, you talked earlier there about this sometimes sugary image that had been portrayed of her, but she had actually quite a lot of suffering, didn't she? And she had her moments of huge doubts about her faith, a bit like Mother Teresa of Calcutta. Do you think all these elements help people to relate to her?
Very much so, yes. I think you've hit on an absolutely central part of her life. She experienced great doubts, really, about the existence of heaven, even of God himself at times. Physical suffering, not just physical suffering, but she'd had her fair share of mental suffering, which, of course, is such a feature of people in the 20th and 21st century. I mean, her childhood could, in some ways, be described as rather neurotic. She was healed of a kind of self-preoccupation, she says, by a vision of Our Lady. And, even as an adult, she was not free of impatience, tendencies to be negative about the other sisters. I mean, life in the convent, although it was very routine and very hard, was also extremely difficult, one might say rather petty compared to the difficulties other people have. But then, of course, she suffered enormously physically from what appears to have been tuberculosis, not properly diagnosed. And part of her teaching is, you don't have to try to be a hero. Your very weaknesses, if you allow them, even your sins, if you allow them, can become a means of humility and therefore a means of drawing down God's mercy. That God is really attracted to people who are humble and empty of any pride. That's what he's really looking for in people.
So how much excitement and interest is there among Catholics in England and Wales, and indeed among the wider community in Britain, ahead of this visit?
There does seem to be a growing sense of momentum and excitement. People say, there is enormous enthusiasm for this. There's a real sense of this is something that is, in a sense, overdue, that it's high time that it happened. We've left it very much to each venue to plan how they're going to use the time they have. And many of them, for example, are holding all-night vigils with young people, holding special services of healing for the sick, events for families. Coaches are being organized from all the different parishes. Schools are involved. And I think possibly, coming as it does this sort of time of the year, the beginning of the academic year, it's a good time. There's a sense of something new in the air, and it's a good time for a visit like this to take place.
There has been some criticism, though, even within the Catholic community. Some see this tour of the relics and even all the other touring that's been done of them across the world as rather bizarre or ghoulish. What's your answer to these critics?
I can understand those those comments, those ideas, because it's not every day that you get the bones of a 19th century saint travelling around the world. And some people, of course, would say, you know, the whole business of relics should be, I was going to say decently buried, but that might not be the best way to put it, but you know what I mean, that it's something that pertains to the Middle Ages. I think on the contrary, in a strange sort of way, the sort of what sometimes we call the postmodern mentality is much more open to these things. If you think, you know, that John Lennon's piano travelled around England, if you think of all the hype over things belonging to Princess Diana or Elvis, you know, one's almost tempted to say that perhaps people outside the church might almost be a bit more open to these things than some Catholics. You know, it is sometimes said, isn't it, that just as the church puts something aside, the rest of the world discovers it. You know, just as we stop talking about angels, everyone else is suddenly talking about angels. Perhaps here is an opportunity for the church to learn from contemporary culture that relics and objects associated with, for us holy people, actually have a great importance.
And what sort of crowds are you expecting in some of the larger venues that the relics will visit? I mean, is it likely that quite a lot of these crowds, in fact, will come, as we talked about just now, out of this rather ghoulish curiosity rather than out of a real faith?
I think a lot of... I wouldn't want to judge that anybody is coming out of ghoulish curiosity. I mean, I hope that everyone who comes, whether Catholic or not, will come in a spirit of openness to at least to receive something from God, even if it's just a, you know, the next step on their path to God. It's very difficult for us to say. When the relics went to Ireland, which is our nearest neighbour, huge crowds were drawn. Whether we'll have quite so many, it's difficult to say. I know that some of the venues, particularly in the north of England, which perhaps are more traditionally Catholic, are preparing for huge crowds, or at least they're preparing for the eventuality of huge crowds, but in a sense we can only wait and see.
So, to sum up, do you anticipate or hope that this tour will help bring about conversions to Catholicism or else help bring people back to the church who might have strayed from the fold?
Well, all we know is that from previous visits there are many testimonies of people whose lives have been deeply touched by the visit of the relics. Some people discover their vocation, some people, yes, have a conversion experience, whether it's to Catholicism or back to the faith, whatever it might be. Other people just seem to have an answer to their problems, I suppose a bit like going to Lourdes. So we treat it very much as a sort of pilgrimage in reverse. You know, many people go on pilgrimage these days in the expectation of, you know, that effort will help to bring about some sort of enlightenment or change in their lives. This is not us going to a holy place. This is a holy person coming to us. And I think that we can expect, yes, many miracles.
I was speaking to Monsignor Keith Baltrop, national organiser of the tour of St. Therese's relics in the UK. Sri Lanka's long-running civil war came to an end in May, but 4 months later, nearly 300,000 Tamil civilians who were trapped in the conflict zone still find themselves confined in government-run camps. Although some 15,000 civilians have been released and resettled so far, international concern is growing over the continued detention of so many civilians in the overcrowded military-run camps. Sanitation is poor inside the camps, and aid workers fear conditions will become dire when monsoon rains begin later this month, with a threat of raw sewage flooding some of the lower-lying areas. The Sri Lankan authorities say they cannot release the civilians until they finish screening them for possible rebel fighters, and until landmines are cleared from their villages in the north of the island. The government has pledged to try to return 80% of the displaced people to their homes by the end of the year, but many are sceptical about whether that promise can be kept. Bishop John Arnold of Westminster Diocese in Britain has just returned from an 8-day visit to Sri Lanka, during which he toured, along with another British bishop, some of the camps for the displaced people. He spoke to me about his impressions.
Well, all I can say is that when the camps were opened, they expected about 150,000 refugee IDPs, and over 300,000 seem to have turned up. So that's put enormous pressure on the camps anyway, but the government at that stage said that within 180 days, they estimated that 80% of those people would have been resettled to their own villages. Now we're about 90 days into that 180-day window, and certainly there hasn't been a great deal of movement out of the camps, but we have that deadline and we must hold the government accountable for it. And if it slips, then we'd need to know the reasons why there is a slippage.
And what are conditions like there? I know you spoke to a priest who was detained there and some nuns who work inside the camp, and you also spoke to people who have already been released from the camp. What did they tell you about conditions?
Well, inevitably, if you open a refugee camp, it's pretty ad hoc in the way it's put together. If two people turn up for every one place that's made available, then the camps are going to be very cramped, and that's certainly what we saw. There was a difficulty, we were told, about latrines. You should really intend at least a minimum of one for 20 people, but it was one for 40 people, so that clearly is inadequate. And we saw a variety of shelters, from plastic sheeting through to tents through to huts with metal roofs.
But I gather that some people are worried that conditions are going to get even worse during the forthcoming rainy season, that there's a risk of floods that may send raw sewage flowing through the camps. I gather that already happened once.
A couple of weeks ago, yes, there was an early rain, and it clearly showed that one of the camps was really on a floodplain. And so there was a lot of damage, particularly to the sewerage system. The commander of the camp in Zone 4 that we met, a brigadier, he acknowledged the seriousness of the timescale in making sure that people are not going to be threatened unduly by the monsoon rains. And there's four camps in preparation at the moment, which are supposedly away from the floodplains, where the people can be more safely kept during the rains. But of course, the questions open then: are these being built now because they're going to be more permanent? Certainly we hope not, because we've got to hold the government to that 180-day deadline.
And do the people there get sufficient food rations and water and, you know, access to washing, for instance?
Well, we certainly saw a lot of efforts being put into the delivery of water, and there doesn't seem to be any difficulty about that. And the World Food Authorities are putting in the basics, but really that's not a particularly attractive diet. So there has been a good deal of work done by Caritas and their partners to supplement the basic foodstuffs. So that's improving to a degree. But of course, these people really shouldn't be there. They should be at home and able to look after themselves.
And what about the morale of the people? I know you talked, for instance, to people who've already been released from the camps. What did they say? How do people feel being, as you say, basically held prisoner in these camps for so many months?
That's right. Well, I've only had one experience of refugee camps elsewhere. And my experience then was that people were relieved to be in those camps because it was away from the violence and the conflict. But here we've got forced confinement, and this is a very sad situation, that 300,000 people should not be in camps, and the sooner they're out the better. The people we spoke to who have been in the camps and confined there said that it was a very difficult place to be, and they were certainly very relieved to be out. But
did they say there was a sense of anger or resentment among the people?
Well, I think there are so many people who, after 30 years of war, are delighted that conflict has come to an end. But that's not the end of the story, is it? Because we've now got to build peace. So I don't think 12 weeks after the cessation of conflict that there's a great deal of anger. But of course, that's something that could easily develop if promises are made and not honoured.
And what's making the resettlement process so slow? You talked about how only a few thousand have so far been allowed to leave the camps for resettlement purposes.
Yes. The reasons we were given by the brigadier were two, mainly. First of all, that there's large areas of ground still mined, and they want to clear the mines before they relocate the people back to their villages. That's going to take time, and some people say that they're not at all sure even which areas have been mined, either by the Tamil Tigers or by the government. So that's taking time. Also, there's this whole business of screening the people in the camps for the CADA and combatants, and trying to make sure that they identify those people who have been involved in the conflict. That may take longer. But whether this is going to mean that a significant number of people remain a long time in the camps remains to be seen, and we must hope that this process can go ahead as quickly as possible.
Now, what are the majority of the people doing all day inside the camps? What activities are being provided for them if they're not allowed to go out and work outside the camps during the day?
Yes, it's not clear. I think there's a great deal of standing around doing very little. There has been an increasing sense among the Caritas workers and their partners that people have become more likely to engage in looking after themselves, in helping to improve the conditions in the camps for themselves, rather than waiting for the authorities to do it. So there can be probably some activity on that part, but we weren't given any indication that there was any real employment for the people in the camps, which is, I think, probably a seedbed for a great deal of discontent if it goes on for very long.
They must be very bored.
I would think so. And then boredom can lead to all sorts of things.
I mean, some people have expressed fears that, you know, if this detention does drag on and if the government doesn't keep his promises in terms of when they should be released, that it could fuel future rebellions against the government.
Well, that I think is true of any conflict, isn't it? If it's not resolved, then new elements of resentment and anger grow. And that means that the government has a great opportunity here. The faster it can relocate people in their homes, allow them to get on with what they want to do in their lives. Many of them are agricultural workers, and they are responsible for a part of Sri Lanka which is really the wheat basket of the island, so they're important for the economy. If that can be moved ahead as quickly as possible, then I think a good deal of goodwill is built up for the future, and a real lasting sense of peace and collaboration among the different sections of the population.
And do people there that you spoke to, both in and outside the camps, feel that this deadline that the government set itself of 180 days for 80% of them to be resettled is feasible?
I think the general impression was that probably the 180 days is not realistic, but if there is a sense of a time scale, then if that slips a bit, that's not so awful, as long as there's still a time scale for resolution. I don't know where they might have plucked 180 days from, but if that's going to, for various reasons, it could slip back. But I think the impetus has got to be that there is a sense of a deadline for getting these people back to their homes.
I was speaking to Bishop John Arnold of Westminster Diocese about his visit to Sri Lanka. That's all from us here at the English programme for today, but we hope you have enjoyed listening to us. We'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes at the click of a mouse on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. We'd also love to hear your comments or suggestions, so do send us an email. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.